You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bunyan of the Heralds of the Gospel. Today we're going to begin a new line in which we're going to be talking about Catholic liturgy. I'm going to begin with the calendar, the liturgical calendar, the calendar in which allows us as Catholics to accompany the church on its year. So hopefully this is of interest. I know that there are many, many people who go to Mass on a regular basis, but don't really understand on the reasons of why. Why is it that the priest is using green? Why is it on this day he's using white? Why all of a sudden do the colors turn purple? And there is a really interesting reason for it, but more than that interesting reason, there is a very deep significance in the way in which we worship. As the Old Testament tells us, there's a time for different things. And we as humans need that time. We need times that things happened and things don't happen. They need times of designated times of fasting, you need times of rejoicing. And that keeps things fresh. That keeps us in a good place. And that allows us to understand the role in which God has within our lives. But more than that, when we look at the commandments and with the transition from Judaic custom to Christian custom, we kept the third commandment, the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath day. Even though the Sabbath was moved from a Saturday to a Sunday, we still do that. And in doing so, sometimes we fail to understand. And not understanding, we can fall into maybe an error, maybe a laxity of sorts. So, let's go to the first point. There are such a thing as days of obligation, and there are Sundays. Sundays are by divine right days in which we worship. Sundays are always a celebration. They're a celebration of Easter. So when we celebrate any Sunday, we have an aspect of Easter celebration involved in it. The days of obligation are special days in which the church rises to that level of necessity, the same level as a Sunday. Here in Canada, we have 2 days of obligation. We're pretty lax in that way. And those 2 days are Easter and New Year's, or the Feast of Mary, Mother of God. Christmas and years. Christmas, of course, being the birth of Christ, which is fixed to a date. And because it's fixed to the date, it tends to move around, and it's not always on a Sunday. And New Year's is the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God. And that, though today that seems like a passed-on element, it has a lot of historic relevance and a lot of necessity to be celebrated. We know that the person of Jesus, we've looked at it before, as hypostatic united to two divine persons, both human and divine, are two items which, for most Christians, I would suspect those who are worthy of the name Christian, that is an accepted doctrine. We know that he is God and man. But in the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries, we really had the church in quite an uproar. And that uproar was concerning the person of Jesus. Who is Jesus? Is he in the Arian concept? Was he Son of God, but not of the same substance? He was human, yes, but he had godlike elements. And if that was true, then his suffering, you would begin to question his the validity and the value of his suffering on the cross, his relationship with the Father, our relationship with the Father, if we are brought into this communion with him, the role of Mary. And the role of many other things that fall into that place. And Arianism struck the Eastern Roman Empire in a very, very powerful way. We'll have some very great saints who will fight against it, who will lose careers, lose lives in face of this Arian menace. Arianism was interesting for a different reason. For the pagan peoples, because you see, the pagan tribal system saw themselves as chief, being in a sense symbolic of the Father, and Jesus, the Son, who does the work of the Father, was a symbol of the church and its relationship with the bishop. So therefore, the chief would be the head of everything, while the bishop, priest, the religious leader, would be merely his servant, would be his slave, would be at a different level completely. You can see how that could bring on many, many problems. Arianism will strike the foundations of many of the other controversies that will happen. So the councils, both of Nicaea, of Chalcedon, and of Ephesus, will be pounding away at defining Mary. Because when we say that Mary is Mother of God, the God-bringer, that her relationship with the Son was that of mother, it changes the whole conversation, because she is Mother of God. She is the mother not just of the person of the human Jesus, but of the complete person of Jesus Christ. And this really helped to solve the question of the Arians, that Jesus was not part-time God. It was not a person of singular elements that God kind of took on, but he was truly God and man. He received his humanity from Mary, but she was the mother of the complete package. And in being mother of the complete package tells you that her particular role that she has in both salvation history, the role of grace, but in a very special way, the role that she has in relation to humanity. Now, this was not without much controversy. As you can tell, three ecumenical councils. In the present day, the most recent ecumenical council was Vatican II, which was held in the 60s. And there are still controversies concerning Vatican II. But there hasn't been another council called. Or another council called. You understand how impressive this was. So the church declares Mary Theotokos. So she is the God bringer in Greek. And then she is declared Mother of God, Mater Dei in Latin, in the Latin church. What's interesting to note is the Latin church didn't have much in the way of problems with this. The reason is many of the bishops who had been removed, deposed of their positions because of their pro-Nicaean or pro-Chalcedon or pro-Ephesus positions had been exiled to the wilds of the West. So they were sent to the barbaric lands of Gaul, of España, or to the islands of Corsica, or as far north as Germany. But with that, these Orthodox bishops end up preaching the true Christology of Jesus and the authentic Marianology. And those areas were kind of immune of these issues. They didn't end up having so much in the way of complications and difficulties. We'll have Hilary of Poitiers. We'll have Irenaeus. Arius of Alexandria. And many others that will end up doing their work in that area. Another heretic that comes out, and this will also kind of couple with the first guy once he's out of the picture, is the Patriarch of Constantinople, Nestorius. Nestorius comes up with this novel concept, which he tries to overcompensate the divinity of Jesus. So, like saying Jesus is God and man, he ends up lowering the humanity of Jesus and accentuating his divinity. Well, divinity we don't have a problem with, because as Catholics, in our identification of it is 100% God, 100% man, and the two are connected, are hypostatic, united in the person of Jesus. So we don't have that issue. But there was an issue, because Nestorius and many others in the East who had been resisting Arius end up falling to the other side of the boat. You see, the same problems that come up with Arius and his diminishing effect of his of Jesus' divinity, if you accentuate the divinity and downplay his humanity, we end up with pretty much the same problem. And that problem is, how could Jesus, who takes on somewhat of a human person, because his divinity is so much greater and more amazing and fascinating than his divinity, how can he save us? How could he suffer? How could he die? And there'll be many other little attributes that come out of this, but it goes back to the same problem with Mary, Mother of God. How could God have a mother? Mary is the mother of the person Jesus, but not the mother of God. So we end up with that problem, and that problem is basically resolved in the councils that come out. And then as time goes by, the emperor expels the heretics out of the empire onto the peripheries. So they go to the Persian or the Sassanid Empire. They go into Arabia. They'll make their way all the way down into India, the Nestorians. The Arians will go north. They'll go into the Germanic tribes. And though this sounds like a great idea, when the fall of Rome happens and we end up having the Goths invade, and we have the Vandals come down from the north, streak through Germany, present-day France, and thrash Spain, and then cross over into North Africa. The term that we use today as vandalization comes from these vandals because they came through and just destroyed. And they were of the Aryan persuasion, and they will kill anyone who's Catholic. And they will thrash, and they will break, and they will burn, and they will take away thousands of years of Carthaginian culture in the north of Africa. The Romans are able to, or what's left of the Romans at that point, are able to make an arrangement with these Vandals to keep them from going to Egypt. But they have destroyed the province of Mauritania and of the old Gothic, I'm not sure, the old Carthaginian province of the area around there, the Nubian Empire, what have you. They just go through and thrash it, and they impose with bloodthirsty efficacy the element of Aryan Christianity. And if you were not going to become an Aryan, then you were to be killed. And those fled, some were rebaptized because the Arians did not accept the Nicene baptism. And this happens. So after all of this blood, all of these battles, all of this destruction, the church brings in this feast of Mary as Mother of God. And this is a special solemnity. So it's placed on our present day New Year's. So New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. So this gives us an idea about our starting our new year under the patronage of Mary, Mother of God. Unfortunately, many Catholics look at New Year's as mainly a secular day in which you celebrate the coming of the new year and then you celebrate it, and which way is your family custom, and then you go to sleep, and then you sleep off the excesses that happened the night before. So that is what's really interesting when we look at it. You know, that is fascinating. So, Mary, Mother of God, why is it such an amazing feast day? Why is it so important? And we've seen it in history. A lot of blood was poured over this feast day. Now, and it was said during the Council of Ephesus that the hedge that protects the person of Jesus is Marian, the Marian theology. If we throw away Marian theology, then we very quickly come to the point of Jesus, what is Jesus? And then we will fall into the various levels of either Arianism or Nestorianism or the multiplicity of other bizarre heresies that exist out there. But where do we fit into this whole deal, right? How many Catholics have you bumped into that will say, I'm not much for Mary. I'm not much for Mary. She's just the mother of Jesus. Now, if you look into that comment, you'll say the question, which is, just the mother of Jesus? Son of God, second person of the Holy Trinity, just part of, you know, just his mother. And that slide ends up bringing on the very other elements that come in, which is that she gets degraded. And then very slowly, these various Protestant denominations begin to degrade the very person of Jesus. They emphasize, let's say, the person, his humanity, and so on and so forth, until you get to a point in which Jesus is no more different than your neighbor Bob. We end up with some of the more liberal Protestant denominations, such as Unitarianism or what have you, or we end up in the other zone. We end up with things like Jehovah's Witness, in which Jesus is basically an Aryan guy. Well, they'll actually switch him up and he'll become St. Michael. And then, yeah, at that point, we're really in a different world. So the Feast of Mary, Mother of God, 1st of January, is so and so important. So what else do we have that are super important feast days within our year? Well, we have the feast day that we just celebrated at the end of Christmas, the Christmas season, which is the feast of the baptism of the Lord. And then we had the week before that, we had the Epiphany, the showing of God through Jesus Christ to the Gentile world. We have the Solemnity of the Holy Trinity, or White Sunday, as it's known, or used to be known in the older days. The feast day of Mary, of the Holy Family of Mary, Joseph, Mary, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, which is found right after Christmas. So these are some major feast days that are found in there. These ones here have a celebration which trumps all others. Nothing else kind of trumps those. You can have the most beautiful feast day, most beautiful saint, and he will not trump one of those days. And lastly, another major marker in the calendar is the last major feast day of the liturgical year, which is Christ the King, right? He's at the end of the year. He's the Alpha and Omega. So we begin the liturgical year with Advent and the preparation for the coming of Christ, and we end the year with the eschatological element of Jesus coming to judge the living and the dead. So you understand how the liturgical year gives us so much in the way of that. It gives us so much because it's like saying, okay, so what do we have? Well, we have Mary, Mother of God. We have the birth of Christ. We have the 4 weeks of Advent. We have all of these elements. But the question is, do we pay attention to all of those things? Do they impact our spiritual lives in the way that we go to Mass? For example, if we go only on Sundays, right, we're going to do the 33 weeks of ordinary time. Though there is matters on the year, there are 34. And we have the 4 weeks of Lent. We have the 6 weeks of Lent. I'm sorry, 6 weeks of Lent, the 4 weeks of Advent. And we have the weeks following. So we have all of these different preparatory elements and Thanksgivings. But do they impact us? Do they live with us? Do they come with us? Do they make us better Christians? Do they help us to see the person of Christ? And if not, then it's time to start cracking on. So we're going to go to a break right now. And after the break, we're going to continue to look over the liturgical year and see how it can impact us ever so more. Be back in a quick moment's time.
Thank you.
to the Catechism Hour. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. So we've looked at the feast day, the Solemnity of Mary, Mother of God, and we've gone through some of the other reasons. The liturgical year is broken into three cycles, A, B, and C. And these are the weekday cycle, and this allows the daily Mass goer to experience almost all of the Bible. It's truly an amazing element. The most important parts of the Bible are all read. And in a comical sense, when someone says that they were Catholic and they never heard the Bible, you almost ask them, did you ever go to church? Because the readings are far encompassing. They bring you from the from Genesis all the way back to Revelation, and when you have that much richness, I can't take you to the fact that you don't drink isn't the fault of the one who offers the drink. It's the one who doesn't actually bring the water to themselves. So we're going to look at the mystery, like we're looking at the mystery of Christ throughout the year. So what would be some of the more important elements? And this one's pretty funny because some people, they don't go to Mass at all, but they go to Mass on particular dates. So you have the Christmas comers, right? Which can be understandable. They have the Christmas and New Year's, Christmas and Easter. And those ones there are a particular crowd that feels they do their duty by darkening the doors of the church at the birth of Christ and when Christ is resurrected. Others, they're a little more peculiar. They like to come out for organic elements. So they come for Ash Wednesday, and they come for Palm Sunday. So they have a thing about plants, considering the ashes are actually burnt palms. So, yeah, it's a thing. You have others that come out for particular feast days during the year. And that comes more from if they come from a culture which is culturally Catholic. So they'll come out for a feast of the Holy Spirit, or they'll come out for a feast of Our Lady, which is based on a particular day in their village or area of their country of origin. But faith is something which is meant for us to live. It's meant for us to bring our souls closer to the one who made us, to greater understanding. So it's really quite sad. It's sort of a case of spiritual anorexia in which we don't feed our souls, or we don't feed our souls enough that it can have an effective life. And that's a real issue because it's greatly saddening. Before I started teaching, I did mission work for 10 years, and part of that was done in Canada, visiting families with a statue, beautiful statue of Our Lady of Fatima, bringing the statue into homes, crowning her as queen, etc. And the amount of interesting stories that I garnished from those 10 years have forever given me a perspective which is very different than many. You see, you would imagine that all of the people that I would visit would be great church-going folk who were all active in their parishes, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, that's not the case. The ones who would want to have the statue visit their homes, a lot of the cases were those who had become distant from the church for many reasons. They could have been reasons of that could be justified, others that could not be justified. Those who came from traditional Catholic cultures, so let's say Hispanics or Portuguese, those ones there are usually the most interesting ones because a lot of times their distancing from the church came from pain, either produced directly by the person, so choices that the person had made, marrying outside the church, doing something within, usually marrying inside the church, actually, not marrying within the church. That was usually the biggest one. Or having a real problem, a row with the local priest. Now, since English wasn't their language of choice, it seemed as though the church got shortened, small, made small into one parish. So if I cannot see eye to eye with Father Joe, then I am not going to church ever again because the church became Father Joe. And even when Father Joe moves on to somewhere else, it still has this problem. And some people use the term time helps to heal. When there are interpersonal problems, time does not help healing. It's sort of like having something stuck in you. Time is not going to make it better. It needs to get the item removed, cleaned, and then fixed. One of the stories I had that was interesting in that sense was I had visited a group of people, family, and they had invited Our Lady to come to their home also. So I arrive at this home at the due time that was expected, and we arrive, we walk in, and I clearly perceive there's this very snazzily dressed individual on the couch with looked like a sidekick of some sort. It's very easy to pick off sycophants. It's an attitude. It's a way of being. And we brought our lady down. We uncovered her, what have you, and then it began. What had come was that this young woman was going to be joining this local evangelical freehold church, but she was giving, in a sense, the Catholic Church their last chance. Non-beholds to me, I had no idea this was the situation that was being set up. So we sat down, we started a conversation. I wasn't exactly prepared for what was going to happen. I was ready for a different setup, a different situation. What was sad was that this Protestant minister guy there, or self-proclaimed guy, I really don't believe he has a degree in anything. His theology was so incredibly between simplistic to wrong. It was rather easy to pick through him but he would make these audacious statements, and then you would be stuck trying to clean up afterwards. The long and short of it, and 2 hours later, just with basic catechism, it wasn't anything extraordinary. Basic catechism, basic knowledge of what the Mass is, what is a sacrament, what is confession, for example, that was a big one, what is baptism. It's going through the basics of our faith. We were able to render this charlatan quiet, silent. And then he packed up with his sycophant sidekick, and they left. And at that point, we prayed the rosary and left. But it was beautiful to see, because afterwards I heard that this lady had become very active in her local parish, and she attributed the visit of Our Lady to her refinding her faith to get over the problems that she was having. Another story which I have that goes in this line is a lady who was a bit older, and she had a group of sisters. She was a love of a large family, and their youngest sister had been the one that she said was this kind of the spoiled one who had been acting out ever since she was young. But she had left the faith. And she, the oldest sister, calls up the younger one and asks her to come over and to pray a rosary. The oldest sister had cancer. So it was a really tragic situation. And the younger one won't come. She finally comes late on purpose. She doesn't live far away. And the oldest sister is trying to help her. And it's not getting anywhere. So at the end of it, we take a picture, all of us with Our Lady, and everyone was sent a copy of that same picture. But it was a really, really hard visit with her. And then the eldest sister demands of her younger sister that she also receive a visit of Our Lady in her home to try to sort things out with herself. Because it was her older sister's request, the sister accepts. So I go there on a Saturday morning with the Our Lady statue. We bring her there, and she is in quite a mood. So we bring her there. She doesn't want to pray. She wants me to pray. She finishes the prayer. We take a picture. I send a picture. As soon as I leave there, kind of like, okay, well, I've done my duty. We're going to move on. This one's not interested. I go out to Western Canada for about 4.5 months. And when I return back, there's a series of notes that are in my little cubby, which has like messages, what have you. This is in the era before really good cell phones. So, and in it has this name, and it says she wants to speak with you. And they call back. She's waiting for your call when you get back. And it was like 4 or 5 messages. I was like, well, strange. Not the same person I remember. So once I got back, I called her up and asked her what was going on. And she goes, I would really like to have Our Lady's statue come and visit me. And I'm like, really? You'd like to have her visit you? Okay, that doesn't sound like you. And she says, well, I will tell you a story when you come. So lo and behold, we mark a date and we come. And what had been a very dark apartment, which had been very messy, and all she had been doing was complaining about everybody else. Everyone, her husband, her children, everyone was the fault. Everyone was the issue. Everyone, oh, it was a lot of hatred going on. So she tells me what happens. She is complaining in her mind about everything in her world, and everything is wrong. And then she ends up opening an envelope, and in the envelope is a picture of her with the statue when I had visited her home. She looks at the picture. She sticks it on her refrigerator, hoping that her sister, if she pops by, will see the picture, you know, that she did it and will get off her case. Lo and behold, the next day she's having a really bad day, worse than normal. She walks by, she looks at the image. And she begins to think, you know, maybe the problem isn't everyone else. Maybe the problem is me. So she's thinking about it. She goes for a walk to clear her mind. And as she goes for a walk, aimlessly, she enters a church. And in entering the church, she sits on in the back of the church on what she looks as a bench. And she sits there and she's looking at what is wrong with my life. And it's, all these problems are coming up. She gets touched and says, you're next. And she gets up half not thinking about it. She walks on in, and lo and behold, she's in confession. And she looks around and she goes, I don't know what I'm doing here. And the priest is very attentive, very understanding, and says, well, you have to be here for a reason. He goes, my life stinks. He goes, okay, well, let's start talking about your life stinking. What's the problem? And as she goes through, the priest asks her one question. But what if this is your fault? What have you done? And then she begins to tell what hurts her, or what she's done to hurt others. And with that, she begins to cry. And the priest gives her absolution. And she leaves. And I go, I was listening. I was like, wow, this is impressive. And she goes, no. What was impressive was, is that I went to confession every day for the next week. And I was like, okay. And he goes, because I felt that I was like a rag that had been so incredibly dirty that you don't clean it on the first try. You clean it after many, many treatments. And each treatment allows it to come up. Each treatment allows it to free up some more of the dirt. Just, and towards the middle of this, I started feeling so light, so happy, so amazing that I was realizing that these problems were mine. I needed to own them. I started going to Mass. And I started seeing that Mass was such a central point that I had so stupidly left aside. The long and short of it, when we went there with the statue, not only was her family present, but she had new friends. Her children were finally smiling. Her husband was smiling. Her house was bright. But what had changed? She had a realization. She had a point in which she had come to a realization of the liturgical year of the church. She began to live the life of the church through the sacraments, through confession. And what was beautiful about it was the sister who had been very sick when she demanded the undemandable from her sister was there present. And her younger sister asked her to crown the statue. And she was now in remission, though it seemed at that time that remission was not on the table. So liturgical year is a way in which we can walk with Christ. But more than walking with Christ, that we live the life of Christ in our year, in our day-to-day. And by living that day-to-day journey, that we end up becoming other Christs. Now, what's another period that is so important? Well, it'll be the Paschal Triduum. So we do 6 weeks of preparation for the coming of Christ, for the greatest sacrifice ever, Christ dying on the cross. And then we move along and we encounter Holy Week, right? In which we have Palm Sunday. And we encountered the glory, but also the suspicion of the peoples. And then we reach the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. In reality, these 3 days are brought into one encapsulated event, the Triduum, the 3 days. So Holy Thursday, we have the Last Supper, right? What's funny is that it's not a day of obligation. And a lot of people believe the days of obligation, one of them, is very much Good Friday. Good Friday, the service of Good Friday, is a continuation of Holy Thursday. There is no Mass. Communion is given, but in a Eucharistic celebration of sorts without Mass. It starts with the Our Father. And how does that affect people? Get much out of it? But what is it? What is it that we need? So those days of obligation are to specially underline those days that we need to go to Mass. But no Catholic would tell you that not going during Holy Week is a good thing. And what's funny is people will go on Holy Friday or Good Friday, and we'll miss Easter Sunday. As I said before, Easter Sunday is the great Easter. The most important feast, the more important Sunday of the year. The most important because at that point our salvation is bought by his resurrection, by his death and resurrection. But this ends up translating to all the other Sundays of the year. All the other Sundays bring forth that very same thing. that same joy. But that's why we liturgically we have to live it. And in living it, we need to bring it forth. So post-Easter is an Easter celebration of 50 days that goes from Easter Sunday until Pentecost. And Easter is such a great day that the 8 days following Easter, we celebrate Easter again and again and again and again and again. Liturgically, it's the same Mass. It's such a special day that we have to celebrate it ever so greatly, ever so more beautifully. The Solemnity of the Ascension in Canada has been moved from Thursday to a Sunday. But those 9 days before Pentecost are usually kept as a novena, the first novena. The apostles had a novena of 9 days, preparing themselves for the coming of the Holy Spirit. And many of us forget about that. Pentecost is the birth of the church. It's the birthday, if you want to put down on your, as a Christian, we are born in Pentecost. Lent's the 40 days, right? So we the 40 days starting with Ash Wednesday until the Thursday of Holy Week. So these days are so special. The liturgical year is so rich. The colors indicate the mode of the liturgy. And with that, we're able to more closely live with Christ, the Good Shepherd. We're more easily able to follow his life as we go through those 3 years. We need to walk ever so closely with the Good Shepherd to get us to that point that we arrive at our last judgment. And our Lord says to us, "You good and faithful servant, come to my Father, come to the house that I prepared, and not be gone from me." But part of that has to do with how we live, how we are, what we do, and how we live our faith. And in living our faith, we bring things forward. We bring things up. We have the rejoicing periods, we have the preparatory periods, we have the sorrowing for our wrongs that we have committed. All of these elements are present. And in being present, it gives us equilibrium. It gives us something proper. I remember talking to one older person, and he told me something that was quite shocking. And then he complained that at church, all they did was talk about death and judgment and suffering and on and on and on. And I kind of changed the subject, and we kind of talked about other things, and I swung myself back. And I asked him, "How often did you go to church?" And after the he's and ha's of it all, he ended up telling me that he only went during Holy Week. So are you surprised that if I only go to Mass during Holy Week, during the Triduum, during Good Friday, let's say, that it's going to be talking about the death of Christ? You only go on that one day of the year, always, and you don't experience the rest of the year. So for us, going forward, let's continue digging into this liturgical year to get the beauties that are present there. I'm going to go into some of the colors. We didn't get into that today because we ran out of time. But we're going with the Christmas time. Understand deeper why. It's the why question. It's so when we go into Mass and we see the priest at the back of the church is dressed in white, or he's dressed in gold, or he's dressed in a purple, or he's dressed in a white, or it's a pink. We understand what is being communicated by that color. and how that color is going to reflect into the opening prayer or the collect. How that's going to reflect in the readings of that Sunday, the first and second reading and the responsorial psalm. How that's going to reflect in the gospel of that day. How that reflects in the Eucharistic prayer. And finally, as we go through, in its final prayer. So those items should communicate something to us. And in communicating, it tells us something special, something that we take with us, so that we live our faith outside as much as we did within the church walls, that we bring Christ, whom we received in Mass, into our homes, and that we are transformed into other Christs. And if we do so, then Mass becomes something important, something real, something fascinating, that the early church members would die for Mass. And it's sad because today we have Mass everywhere and people don't necessarily take advantage of it. So, until next week, may God bless you and may Our Lady guide you.
You've been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bonnion, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.